It's 12:06 and time for Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. Feel free to join today's conversation by giving us a call at 260-452-1185. Post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, happy to be doing this pre-Valentine's Day show with you today. And because it's the day before Valentine's Day, we're going to be talking about all matters of the heart, and it's also Heart Disease Awareness Month this month of February. Our show is divided in two different parts today. On the second half of the program, we'll be joined by Dr. Joseph Ladowski, who will be speaking on heart transplants and ventricular assist devices. But first, I'll have my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, introduce our first guest for the first half of today's show.
Thank you, Sarah. Today, we will be first discussing the acute heart attack with Dr. Mark O'Shaughnessy, cardiologist from the Parkview Physicians Group Cardiology Department. More than 1.2 million people in the United States have heart attacks each year, and about half of these people have a heart attack for the first time. Many of these people will wait 2 hours or more after their symptoms begin before they seek help, and it's been pointed out that as fast as you can get help and get to an appropriate emergency facility, your chances of surviving and doing well improve. And here to describe what you should do when you have a heart attack, what will be done to you when you get to the emergency facility and in the hospital, is Dr. Mark O'Shaughnessy. Dr. O'Shaughnessy, what is the first thing, that the signs and symptoms that the patient might recognize in the home, and what should they do?
Well, first off, thank you for having me here. Well, the classic symptoms of a heart attack are chest pain. The classic chest pain is an elephant standing on one's chest, radiating down the left arm, typically to the left jaw, shortness of breath, sweatiness, sickness to their stomach. That's classic heart pain. However, less than 50% of patients present with classic symptoms, and women more so than men present with atypical presentations. And so my rule of thumb is, if it's a persistent symptom from the waist up, you need to seek assistance. And if it's a severe symptom, you need to call 911. As you pointed out, you have to get to the hospital as quickly as you possibly can and have us get, if it's a heart attack, get that vessel open. The heart attack is caused by a blood clot that's forming inside one of the arteries that supply the heart. The heart has to have blood supply or it dies very quickly. And so we have a saying, time is muscle. And so the more time you waste at home, the more muscle gets injured. Once I get that vessel open, I can salvage muscle. So it's critically important that if we're having recurring symptoms, you don't call your Aunt Minnie and ask what I should do. You don't call your neighbor or your mother. You call 911. One of the most startling statistics that we have, we collect statistics and data for the last 30 years regarding heart attacks at Parkview Hospital, and we have data at the most fine, infinite detail. But 40% of our patients still drive themselves or have a loved one drive them to the hospital, and it just was startling to us. And so it's critically important. Call 911. The barrier is people say, well, I don't want to be embarrassed. I don't want to go there and have it not be my heart. From our standpoint, a physician will never criticize you for calling 911. We're not going to say, why did you call them? We're going to go through. If it's not a heart attack, we all have a sigh of relief. If it's a heart attack, we're going to take care of that heart attack. We're going to take care of it quickly. The other important thing about 911 is the ambulance services can do wonderful things of getting therapy started in your home before you make it to us. And more importantly, they can do an EKG, the diagnostic test, send that to us over the Ethernet or the telephone wires. We look at it. We get the cath lab ready. You bypass the ER. You go directly to the cath lab, and we get that vessel open very quickly. And so it's critically important that if you're having those recurring and persistent symptoms, you call 911. You get to the hospital quickly.
And when they have the pain, how many minutes would you allow before they react? And should they take the 325 aspirin?
Yeah, if you have aspirin, I wouldn't go out to the store and buy aspirin, certainly. But if you have aspirin in your home, I think it's very reasonable to do that. I think if you're having a pain that's lasting longer than 5 minutes, you need to notify somebody that this is going on. And if it's that classic chest pain or a heartburn that's not going away, you let somebody know about that and you get to the hospital quickly. I can't tell you how many patients they say, I thought it was just heartburn, or I thought it was just a muscle pull, or I thought it was this or that or the other thing. You can't tell over the telephone, or I can't tell over the telephone. You can't tell without us doing some diagnostics. So if it's lasting 10 or 15 minutes, you've got to get some medical assistance. All of us have symptoms in our chest, certainly. But if this is a symptom that you've never had before, and you're very concerned about it, my rule of thumb is if you think you're having a heart attack, call 911. Don't wait.
And once they get into the cath lab, what procedures do you do? Well, first, when they hit the hospital, lab work is drawn, an electrocardiogram is taken. Then what happens to the patient?
So if they come in the first thing that we do is we have a DORDIC, what's called DORDA data time. And so again, we collect data, you know, ad infinitum on these patients. So we know from the time you hit the emergency room door to the time we get your EKG, what time is that? From the time you get your EKG, it's called data to decision time. How long does it take me to make a decision to heart attack or not a heart attack? So if you're having what's called an ST elevation heart attack, myocardial infarction, that's a certain thing on our EKG, we're whisking you off to the cath lab. What's important nowadays is because of our technology, the ambulance services can do those EKGs in the field. We don't waste time drawing blood. We basically fax that EKG to us. We look at it, get the cath lab there. The cath lab is ready. The patient comes directly to the cath lab, bypassing the emergency room, get them on the table. Then what's going to happen to the patient is we're going to basically pass a small tube from their artery in their leg up to their heart, inject some dye, contrast material, down the vessels, and get a roadmap of their arteries. And then we find which one's plugged. These are actually caused by blood clots. Heart attacks are caused by blood clots that form over the blocked areas inside the blood vessel. The stuff that plugs up our blood vessels is a whole topic in and of itself, but it's fat and cholesterol and bunches of other stuff. But then a blood clot forms. And when a blood clot forms over there, no other blood can get through there. The heart's an organ that we call an obligately aerobic organ. It has to have oxygen in order to survive and continue to work. If I close off the blood supply, I close off the oxygen supply, the muscle begins to die. So what we do is we get this roadmap, we find the blocked artery, we pass a wire through that blockage, and we actually have some extraction devices where we can just basically suck the clot out of it, get the vessel open quickly, and then we follow that with either an angioplasty or a stent. And a stent is basically a old Chinese finger torture game that we had when we were kids. I'm not sure they're around anymore. Springs inside a pen, but basically they're deflated. When you inflate a balloon, you deploy this stent and it scaffolds the vessel open. And now I have prompt flow going back down that blood vessel. And as soon as I get the prompt flow, the muscle that was dying begins to heal itself.
And the choice of the stent, you have the stents that have medication and stents without medication.
Right. So when we do regular balloon angioplasty, basically the blood vessel is a very complex biology, but there's multiple layers. When I do regular balloon angioplasty, I tear the inner layers of the blood vessel. Your body heals that like any other part of your body. The blood vessel is not much bigger than the end of a Bic pen. I mean, it's 2 to 3 millimeters in diameter. It doesn't take too much scar before it re-narrows itself back down. So with regular balloon angioplasty, 40% of patients came back within 6 months with too much scar, and it became a revolving door. Every 6 months we were doing angioplasty because we had nothing else available. Mm-hmm. Then came along the bare metal stents, and stents basically allow us to scaffold the vessel open at a much bigger area than the surrounding vessel. So when it scars down, it doesn't scar down to the point where it causes a limitation in the blood flow. But still 20% of patients came back with too much scar. Well, now we have drug-coated stents that have a drug on them. It's a chemotherapy drug that actually prevents scar formation. And so the chance of re-narrowing a drug-coated stent is less than 2%. There's a 98 to 99% chance that vessel is going to stay open long-term. The cost, however, is that you don't form scar, there's bare metal inside the artery. And if there's bare metal anywhere inside one's body, the body doesn't like that, and it'll form a clot over that. And if you clot off that blood vessel, you're right back to square one where you have a heart attack. And so in patients who have a drug-coated stent, they have to stay on blood thinners, two of them, aspirin and Plavix, or aspirin and other kinds of medications, potent medications that prevent blood from clotting again. The decision to use angioplasty versus stent, bare metal stenting versus drug-eluting stent is based on lots of things. One is the anatomy. Can I get that type of stent in that location? The size of the blood vessel. Is the patient going to be compliant with their aspirin and the Plavix? Do we think if they're going to stop it, they're going to close off that blood vessel with a clot, and we don't want them to do that. If they have an impending surgery coming up, if they have to say they have to have some other type of a surgery, an appendectomy or a knee surgery or something like that, we're not going to put a drug-coated stent in because I have to stay on the dual antiplatelet therapy, two blood thinners, for at least a year after a drug-coated stent. So you'll get the drug-coated stent, you'll get a stent placed in there because we almost always do stents now. They work better. There's less re-narrowing with them. And then we send the patient from the cath lab up to our intensive care unit just to make sure they're not going to have complications of a heart attack. And those complications are your heart has an electrical system, and so if you irritate the electrical system, you can have short circuits and you can have bad heart rhythms, and so we want to monitor that. The heart, first and foremost, is a pump. And if you damage that pump enough, if you're not moving blood forward, it can back up and we can get things called congestive heart failure. So we watch those patients in the intensive care unit just for those complications of a heart attack.
I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Health 360 here on WBOI 89.1 FM. And if you have any questions or comments, we're talking about acute heart attacks during the first half of our show today. We're focusing the whole show today on heart disease and heart attacks. So do give us a call, 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or send us an email, middaymatters@nipr.fm. I want to back up a little bit and talk a little bit about the signs of a heart attack. Does gender play a role in this? Do women experience a heart attack differently than men do?
It's an excellent question. Well, first off, heart disease, cardiovascular disease, heart attack and stroke is the number one killer of both men and women. Mm-hmm. Women believe that their primary thing that's going to cause them to die is breast cancer. 1 in 7 women will die of breast cancer. 1 in 2 women will die of cardiovascular disease. So it's the number one cause of death. But the point is that, yes, women present differently. And 10, 12 years ago, we were criticized as a chauvinistic, male-dominated subspecialty. And to a certain extent, that may be true. But that's not the reason why we were not treating women appropriately. Women present differently. Women present typically 10 to 15 years later than men, primarily because of their estrogen. Estrogen is protective, and once they go through menopause, they catch up with us quickly. Women's arteries are smaller than men's arteries, and so they don't behave with angioplasty and stenting and bypass surgery similar to men. And their presentations are different. And, you know, 15 years ago, we did not realize that. But women do have atypical presentations, and so we are much more in tune to that now. And so there isn't one way that I can say, well, that's a woman's symptom, this is a man's symptom. Basically, if a woman has a recurring symptom, again, from the waist up, you need to seek medical attention. If it's not a serious thing, if it comes and goes, talk to your primary care physician. But if it's a symptom that's not going away and it's bothersome, you need to seek emergency medical attention so we can sort out, is it your heart or is it something else? Mm-hmm. If it's something else, wonderful. But your heart is something you can't wait, because once the horse is out of the barn, I can't close the barn door.
Mm-hmm. And it's been stated that that women may have a higher frequency of death with a heart attack, and that younger women who have heart attacks are more at risk than older women. Is there's some age differential issues
from
here
from
too?
A mortality standpoint? Yes. And the reason being is that if the biology of the vessel is, if I close the vessel slow enough, your body has a response of creating new blood vessels around that area. They're called collaterals, and so you'll actually bypass those blocked arteries. If you're a young person, the vessel closes off because of a clot forming there. You don't have enough time to form those collaterals. Those collaterals form over months to years. If I suddenly close a blood vessel off, I don't have enough time to have created those collaterals, and so the amount of muscle injury is much greater because you don't have the collateral development in a younger person, both men and women. But that's exactly right from a woman's standpoint, because the perception is, I'm a young woman, I can't have heart disease. And the reality is that's not true. And so it's critically important that women do have heart disease. My youngest heart attack in a woman was 21 years old, had extremely strong family history, was a smoker, had other risk factors. So it can occur in young people.
I want to touch a little bit on risk factors and then move on to family history, because there are a lot of folks that aren't aware of their family history. And it's always a good idea to kind of have a sense of that to see if you are at risk for heart attack and heart disease. So let's talk a little bit about those risk factors. How are people putting themselves in danger to have a heart attack?
Well, I think the most important thing is another thing we like to say is know your numbers. You cannot be part of your health unless you know what your numbers. So the traditional risk factors are family history, male gender, we have a higher incidence as compared to women, although women catch up with this, cigarette smoking, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. So again, I want people to know what your cholesterol is. You say, well, my family doctor knows. Well, maybe they do, maybe they don't. But you can't be a member, be part of your own health if you don't know what those numbers are. So you need to know what your cholesterol is, what your sugar is. Are you a diabetic or not? What high blood pressure? And I'm an unapologetic supporter of the smoking ban. Cigarette smoking is the number one cause of heart disease in America, bar none. We know exactly how it works. So the ones you can change, you can't change your family history.
Right.
So if you have a family history, you have one strike against you. If you're a man, you can't change your gender, or at least not desirably. So you have two strikes against you. So you've got to do everything else right. Do you know what your sugar is, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and don't smoke.
We have a phone call on line one. We have Fred, who actually wants to talk about his own experience having a heart attack. Fred, welcome to Health 360.
Thank you. Great subject. 7 years ago, actually, I think about it, the advantages is what you can accomplish in 7 years if you don't die. But in those 7 years, I've done so much to counsel people, men and women, who have, number one, family backgrounds and smoking and lifestyles, and to get in and get it looked at. Mine was entirely predictable in terms of symptoms that I absolutely ignored for many years. And had I actually gone in and honored my body's call, I would have probably been stented instead of bypassed. So a wonderful program, great topic. The main thing is people need to get in and pay attention to what their body is telling them.
Thanks, Fred. Thanks so much for sharing that.
Sure.
What about angina? Many people will have stable angina with recurrent episodes of pain, but about 20% can go on to have a heart attack. How do people differentiate angina or the heart attack, and how should they seek care, and to what extent for their angina symptoms?
So if they have angina, they should have an evaluation period, because angina is basically chest pain related to the heart. It's pain from your heart. So you need to get an evaluation to say how much artery disease you have. And there's lots of non-invasive ways of us getting an assessment of that. If your angina is stable and doesn't change in a pattern, and it's been evaluated and everybody's comfortable with that, then that's all well and good, and you don't need to worry about that. If the angina changes in character, in severity, in frequency, in duration, that's the saying, we got to do something different about this. So if you're new to having chest pain and never been evaluated, you need to be evaluated first. And then we have our patients who have stable coronary artery disease, and they have stable angina. And we just say, as long as you can do the type of activity you've been doing for quite a while, the stable angina, that's fine. We leave that alone. But when it changes in quality, duration, severity, that's the sign you need to do something more aggressive about that.
You are listening to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOI. Any questions or comments, 260-452-1185 is the number to call. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or send us an email, middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio today by my co-host Peter Rothman, as well as Dr. Mark O'Shaughnessy from Parkview, and we're discussing heart attacks during the first half of today's program. I wanted to back up just a second and reflect a little bit on the caller that we just had, Fred, who talked a little bit about his experience having a heart attack and ignoring some of the warning signs. If you are somebody who has a family history and you know that this could be an issue for you, when do you need to start going to the doctor to get your heart checked out? If you're perfectly healthy otherwise, folks may just think that, well, I'm fit, I exercise, I eat well, that doesn't apply to me.
Well, yeah, so that's an excellent point as well. First off, I can't look at two people and say, well, that person is skinny and fit, and he doesn't have heart disease, and this person is not.
Sure.
And so the question is, say I have some risk factors, and I know my number. You need to go to your family doctor, your primary care physician, just for routine health maintenance type of activities anyways. And part of that is checking your blood pressure and your sugar and your cholesterol and those type of activities. But say you've done all that, and your question is, do I or don't I have the disease? I have a family history, but I don't know I have the disease, and I have no symptoms, of course. The best screening study, just for screening means that I'm actually looking to say, do you or don't you have the disease process? And I want to do something to try to prevent that disease from ever manifesting itself. Mammography is a classic example. You don't have breast cancer, you're doing it for screening. Colonoscopy for colon cancer. The best screening study from a heart standpoint is a coronary calcium score. Mm-hmm. It's a fancy CAT scan of one's chest without contrast. It's a non-invasive study. It's a $50 test. You don't have to disrobe for it. There's no IV sticks. There's no blood draws. And we're looking for calcium in your coronary arteries. The stuff that plugs up our blood vessels is very complex biology, and again, another whole other topic mm-hmm. in and of itself. But if calcium is present, you have the other stuff there. And so it's a yes or no answer to your question. It's a great screening study. It's extremely accurate. If there's calcium there, you have disease. If there's no calcium there, you have about a 98% negative predictive value, which means with 98% certainty, you don't have disease. And so say, look, I have some risk factors I want to know, do or I don't I, because I might alter my lifestyle to try to make sure I mitigate any possibility of having an event. Coronary calcium scoring is absolutely the best approach at doing that.
The amount of the percentage of people that actually die from the first heart attack, you mentioned earlier, and those that survive, which is the extreme majority, what other than the aspirin and the Plavix, what other medications and lifestyle changes and cardiac rehabilitation is in store for those people who survive their attack?
So if you come into me a virgin patient, never had any heart disease or any other medical problems, you're going to go home on 5 medications. The medications are the aspirin and the Plavix, the blood thinners. Typically a cholesterol medication, because your cholesterol, no matter what it is too high, you've had heart disease. Okay, we'll lower your cholesterol. A medication called a beta blocker. The examples are toprol or lopressor, metoprolol, Coreg, atenolol. And beta blockers are blood pressure medications, but they actually protect the heart. They protect the heart and let the heart heal itself. And then another medication called an ACE inhibitor. They're the pril medications, lisinopril, captopril, all those medications. And so those are the 5 medications we send you home on, mainly because that we know that they will allow your heart to heal and remodel itself in an appropriate way. The lifestyle modifications are doing the things that I would hope that people were doing anyways, which are exercising on a daily basis. That's what cardiac rehab is, basically to try to teach them how to do that. Any lifestyle modification, I believe, takes 3 months to get ingrained in your normal daily activities. And so we do 3 months of cardiac rehab trying to make sure that they try to do that. During rehab, we do education, dietary education, and obesity is a huge issue nationwide. Again, another whole other program. But I believe the reason why we're obese is not so much what we're eating, it's how much we're eating. And so we talk about dietary moderation. We talk about making sure your blood pressure is under control and your sugar is under control. So just those simple lifestyle modifications, if we institute them as a children, we won't be. I'll put myself out of a job, which is the ultimate goal from a prevention standpoint.
We have a caller on line one and just a few more minutes left in the first half of today's program. Dick, welcome to Health 360.
Yes. I'd like to ask you, doctor, I did have it was heart, it was a defibrillating heart all of a sudden, and also a congestive heart failure. It caused me about 5.5 hours in the emergency room and around and before, where I swear it was like waterboarding must be. I was for that period constantly trying to breathe, gasp for air, and of course that makes it worse. So you have to be as calm as possible. So my question is, what's the difference in especially pre-attack symptoms for heart attack, and is this included a form of heart attack? I know it's referred to in a general way as that, but I know that's not quite true.
Well, I think that you bring up a couple. There are several different heart rhythm abnormalities that you talk about. One is what's called atrial fibrillation, which is a different type of rhythm, but you can feel very poorly with atrial fibrillation. It's coming from the upper chambers. But the symptom you were describing was that severe shortness of breath or air hunger. It's called dyspnea, and there's no worse sensation, I think, in the world than that. And that's because of fluid backing up in your lungs from a cardiomyopathy or congestive heart failure standpoint. So one of the symptoms, the unusual symptoms, is not having any chest pain, but severe shortness of breath. If there's severe shortness of breath as a symptom, then you definitely need to seek medical attention in that situation, because that could be your marker. We actually have a name for it. We call it dyspnea equivalent to angina. So if it's just shortness of breath as your manifestation, if you have an unexplained symptom, you need to seek attention.
Right.
Well, I must tell you, I had a pacemaker put in by out at Parkview, and it was an amazing, amazing change. And in fact, for the first 24 hours, I couldn't believe it made such a difference. I thought I was being over almost euphoric, but it turned out that was exactly correct, and that's pretty well handled the problem.
Great. That's great to hear. Thank you so much for calling in, Dick. And we have one last question that I want to get to before we have to say goodbye to Dr. Mark O'Shaughnessy today. Laura wants to know, I'm a 52-year-old female and my blood pressure is very high during the day and normal at night. My doctor said I don't need to worry about it, but I wanted to check with a professional. Should I seek a second opinion?
It's always appropriate to seek a second opinion no matter what. Blood pressure does fluctuate throughout the day. There's a circadian rhythm to it. So it depends on how high the blood pressure is, whether it's out of range that you needed to do something differently about that. So, the best place to start is your primary care physician. I always think a second opinion is appropriate. The only thing that the second opinion can do is just corroborate what the first doctor says. And so absolutely, I think it needs to be evaluated. But again, it depends on what ranges we're talking about, if it's very, very high.
Great. And thank you so much for being a part of today's program.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break for the news here on Health 360 on WBOY 89.1 FM. But when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Joseph Ladowski about heart transplants and ventricular assist devices. So stay tuned for that. This is 89.1 FM.
Dave Boone has been a joke writer for the Academy Awards for years, and he loves it.
Getting paid lots of money and getting all the perks that come with sitting backstage on a folding chair in a tuxedo.
If there's a golden rule for the night, he says,
you go to Jack Nicholson whenever you can.
From Billy to Whoopi, Oscar Writing 101 with us today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered airs weekday afternoons at 4 on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Good afternoon, I'm Sean Beter with WBOI News. The city of Fort Wayne is launching a comprehensive study of its downtown rivers as part of an effort to spur development along those riverfront areas. Mayor Tom Henry says the study will examine environmental issues, flooding, navigation, and recreational uses. He said Tuesday the goal is to, quote, provide the roadmap to world-class investment. The city has set aside up to $500,000 for the study. Fort Wayne was founded at the confluence of the St. Joseph, St. Mary's, and Maumee Rivers. Numerous studies have urged officials to take better advantage of the city's waterways, but no study has looked at how to use them, whether they can be used, and what their use might mean for development. Former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar used his first public speech since leaving office in January to warn that political partisanship is, quote, out of control in the U.S. Lugar also said during Tuesday's speech at Duke University that a massive industry makes money off of political discord and has an interest in keeping it going. The 80-year-old Lugar said in prepared remarks that many cable news networks, talk radio stations, think tanks, websites, and fundraising groups, quote, have a deep economic stake in perpetuating political conflict. He said those entities are successfully marketing and monetizing partisan outrage. As lawmakers work to create the Indiana Career Council, meant to coordinate the state's workforce development efforts, they're placing a special emphasis on addressing unemployment among recent veterans. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith has that story.
The unemployment rate for Indiana's post-9/11 veterans is 20%, more than double that of the average Hoosier. Indiana National Guard Employment Coordination Program Manager Catalina Carrasco says part of the reason so many young veterans are unemployed is a disconnect between veterans and employers.
Sometimes they just even put in all their work experience, especially their military experience, down on paper, on a resume, in a way that civilian employers can understand that, and they can see how those skills and experience is transferable to their needs.
Indiana National Guard Chief of Staff Brian Copes says the Indiana Career Council can help educate private sector employers and dispel their concerns.
There is a bit of tribal lore and a reluctance because of the visibility that PTSD has gotten in the news. It is a very, very small percentage, but it gets a lot of media coverage. And so employers have just a bit of reluctance going, am I going to hire that person?
Legislation creating the Indiana Career Council unanimously passed the Indiana House Tuesday. It now heads to the Senate. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
And the Indiana Pharmacy Board has revoked the state license of a Massachusetts pharmacy linked to an outbreak of fungal meningitis that's killed 10 people in Indiana and sickened about 70 others. Attorney General Greg Zeller said Tuesday that New England Compounding Center cannot operate in Indiana for at least 7 years. The company could apply for a new license afterward, but it would need the board's approval. He says the pharmacy failed to ensure its epidural steroid injections were safe for patients. The tainted steroids were distributed to 6 Indiana clinics before the company recalled them. Zeller says the U.S. Centers for Disease Control has identified 10 deaths and 79 total cases of fungal meningitis in Indiana from the pharmacy's steroid injections as of February 4th. You're listening to Midday Matters Health 360 here on WBOI.
Welcome back to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. The time is 12:37. Questions or comments, 260-452-1185 is the number to call. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or you can send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio today by my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, who's going to be introducing our next guest.
Our next guest will be Dr. Joseph Ladowski, cardiovascular and thoracic surgeon, Indiana/Ohio Heart of the Lutheran Medical Group. And we will be asking Dr. Ladowski to tell us more about heart transplantation and the ventricular assist device. And this is a modality for the patient with end-stage heart failure, where all other modes of therapy have not been effective. We just talked about the acute heart attack. Now we're at the other end of the spectrum of the patient who survived but is not doing well. Who are the candidates for a heart transplant, Dr. Ladowski, and how is this done?
Well, thanks for having me on, and happy Heart Month. candidates for a heart transplant are those patients who have end-stage heart failure. Dr. O'Shaughnessy was beginning to talk about the consequences of having multiple heart attacks or a single very large heart attack, which might damage irreversibly the muscle of the heart so that it doesn't pump blood around very well. And as that caller before called in and said, it's a horrible feeling to have the left ventricle, which is responsible for pumping blood around to the body, not be able to do that. As a result of that, the blood backs up into the lungs, and basically the patient is then drowning. And that's one of the most common sensations that a patient with congestive heart failure will have. If we have a problem with the heart, and the vast majority of hearts, with the coronary arteries, we can bypass those or stent them. With a valve, we can repair or replace it. But when the muscle of the heart itself is irreversibly damaged and can't pump blood around anymore, there's no good way to repair that, and it needs to be replaced or supplemented. And the replacement that's been around successfully since the late 60s, really, is heart transplantation, to actually substitute that heart with someone else's heart. Obviously, there's a lot of problems that occur because of that, and one of the most important of those is the possibility of rejection. Anytime you have a living tissue in you that you weren't born with, your immune system has a tendency to try to reject it and damage it. So a patient who has a heart transplant will have to be on immunosuppression medications for the rest of their life. And those have side effects, and they're not perfect. I always tell people who are considering a heart transplant that you are not getting a secret potion or a magic wand that fixes everything miraculously. Instead, you're trading one set of problems for another. And the set of problems that you're getting rid of are the fact that you are soon to die. And the problems that you are inheriting are that you're going to have somebody else's heart in you, and you will have to take medications for the rest of your life to make sure that that doesn't reject. So those patients who have had multiple heart attacks or one big heart attack and their heart muscles not pumping around, or there's another population of patients who have never had a heart attack and their coronary arteries are wide open, but their muscle just starts failing for some unknown reason. Oftentimes it's thought to be due to a viral effect upon the muscle and an autoimmune type of injury to the muscle. Sometimes we just don't know, and those are called idiopathic cardiomyopathies. Doctors use that term idiopathic a lot. It derives from two different words, and it's supposed to mean we don't know what causes it. But in medical school, I always thought it meant that the doctor's an idiot and the patient's pathetic, and that's just a contraction for the two. Mm.
Dr. Ladowski, how many heart transplants are performed in the United States? How many are done here at Lutheran Hospital? And the survival rates of these patients, how well are we doing these days?
Great question, and that's exactly what you're going to want to know if you are a patient who has been referred for consideration for a heart transplant. So to start with, what you need to know is that the government did a large study not too long ago, which, as part of the study, followed the fate of people who were referred for a heart transplant, had all of the things that needed a heart transplant, but for one reason or another, usually age, did not get a heart transplant. And what you need to know is that at the end of 2 years, 8% of them were alive. So getting referred for a heart transplant indicates that you are not long to live. So that's what you need to start with in your mind as a comparison against the statistics with heart transplantation. So to answer your questions in order, heart transplantation is one of those technologies that you can't just reach on a shelf and pull a donor organ off and plug it in. The entire process is limited entirely by donor availability. And there are only about 2,000 to 2,200 heart transplants done per year in the country. And the places that can do them are severely limited. There are 100, and I just looked this stuff up yesterday to be able to answer correctly for you. There are 146 heart transplant centers in the country. We are the only heart transplant center at Lutheran Hospital from Chicago to Toledo to Ann Arbor, going north to Grand Rapids and going south to Indianapolis. Of the 146 centers, we did more than 46 of them last year. So we're in the top 100 in terms of volume, and we did 9. So not an everyday thing. And that is why, and that's the segue into why the mechanical option is becoming so much more an option now and will be even more so in the future. Okay, so to answer one more question that you did ask is, what are the statistics? And again, I just looked these up. In the last 3 years of the heart transplants that we've done, of those available for 2-year follow-up, 91% of them are alive. So that's your contrast, 8% without a heart transplant, 91% with a heart transplant. Our own program has been around since 1985. It was started back then by Dr. Ron Scaringa and Dr. Tommy Tomisk and Mike Schatzlein and Alan Peterson and Dr. William Clark. And so we have a sort of a unique situation where we've actually have an opportunity to follow a lot of patients over a long period of time. And our 10-year survivals are a little over 50%. And our 15-year survivals, this is with 153 patients, are 31% now.
Excellent.
So, yeah, if you can, it's the way to go.
And for those patients who either for a variety of their own health who have on dialysis, failing kidneys, old age, are unable to receive the heart transplant, we do have another option, which is the ventricular assist device. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. The concept of an artificial heart was started out in the early 60s. You may remember, well, I remember. I suppose most people listening won't remember, but the Kennedy administration and his initial inaugural address was so full of hope and promise. And we, as a nation, had just won the Second World War. We were unparalleled, unquestioned in our supremacy in the world. We had great wealth, and so we were going to go to any length, accept any risk, endure any hardship in order to accomplish our goals. And one of them was to go to the moon. Another one people don't remember is we were going to have an artificial heart. And so the NIH put out $1 million grants, three of them, to three different companies to try to develop an artificial heart. And it sounds laughable that you would give $1 million to anybody and think they'd get far with it nowadays, but this was the early 60s, so it probably was a considerable sum. In any event, what we learned is that there are a lot of hurdles to trying to create an artificial heart. One of them is that anytime you ask a mechanical device to pump 70 or 80 times a minute for years and years, it wears out. There are a lot of durability issues. The other is, associated with that, the power source to run that thing has got to be incredibly big. And the first ones, the battery packs weighed 480 pounds. They were huge, and the patient was tethered to it continuously. Another one is that anytime you take human blood and put it in contact with an artificial surface, it has a tremendous tendency to clot. And so biocompatible surfaces had to be developed, and anticoagulation regimens had to be developed to make sure that those clots didn't happen. You may remember some of the early artificial heart experiments in the 80s with Barney Clark were damaged badly by the fact that he had strokes because of those clots forming. In any event, since the 60s, there's been a gradual evolution and improvement to the point where just in the last few years, just 10 years ago or so, we had a device that was fairly durable, had a battery pack that was fairly portable, and didn't have a lot of clot formation problems. And at that point, the government said, okay, so far the strategy has been that this device doesn't work very long, and it tethers the patient to a large battery pack. The only time we use it is as what's called a bridge to transplant. In other words, if we have a heart transplant candidate who is dying and we can't get a donor in time, we would put in a mechanical option only so long as we could keep them alive until we had a donor available, and then take out the mechanical heart, put in a heart transplant. Well, at that point, about 10 years ago, the government said, okay, these devices are good enough where we will allow a certain number of places to start putting them in as what's called a destination therapy. You put that in with no expectation that the patient will have a heart transplant. And that is when that rematch study was done that I alluded to earlier, where they took 128 patients and they randomized them, half of them to receive a device, and it's the older generation device. It's the one we used before the one we're using now. The other half got best medical management, the best medications available to humankind. And at the end of 2 years, with the device, 28% of people were alive. Without the device, 8%. Not great numbers. You don't write home about something like 28% success. But since then, we have a better device. And right now, there is a society, there's a agency that the government has mandated will keep track of the centers that are doing destination therapy, because they didn't just say, okay, anybody can do it. You have to go through a fairly rigorous process as an institution and as a surgeon to be able to do this. There are only 114 hospitals in the country that are allowed to do destination therapy implants. We're the only one in the region. My partner, Dr. Alan Peterson, and I are the only ones who are certified in this area to do that. And our statistics at Lutheran Hospital with this over the last 3 years is that the Intermax agency that follows all of these things reports in the country for over 6,600 of these destination VADs. Three-year survivals are 58% now. Three-year survivals are 58%. And ours at Lutheran are 70%.
And the procedure itself, could you describe where you put it, where it is in the body, and how mobile these individuals are and how they can get back to a reasonable lifestyle?
Now, for the devices, we have at Lutheran four different devices. It's not a one-size-fits-all thing. So the one I'm about to talk about is the one that's most commonly used for destination therapy, and the one that gives the best mobility options for a patient. They can go home with this, and they can do just about anything they want to do. We advise them not to drive a car for legal reasons, and they cannot swim because they can't immerse the whole thing. It's a big operation. I don't want anybody to believe that it's a simple thing or minimally invasive. It is open-heart surgery. The patient, while anesthetized, has a sternotomy, so an incision up and down through the breastbone, just like for a coronary bypass or a mitral valve or aortic valve procedure. The device itself is approximately 12 centimeters long. It's a tubular thing that's approximately, I would say, 5 or 6 centimeters in circumference. And it has an inlet cannula and an outlet cannula. So two little tubes, one going in, one going out. and the one going in is attached directly to the left ventricle of the heart. The device then resides in the abdominal wall, right underneath the incision, underneath the left rib cage, really, inside, totally inside. And then the outflow graft is sewn onto the aorta. And the device spins. It doesn't pump like a heart. It spins so that the blood is displaced in a continuous way. That leads to some very interesting physiology because you don't get a blood pressure on a patient like this. You get a continuous one line of flow instead. And the reason for that is because those types of pumps are much more durable from an engineering standpoint. And it's expected that that device will last for 15 to 17 years. And they do in lab testing. Now, the Achilles heel of this whole thing is that anytime you have a mechanical device within your body and there is exit of the mechanical device to the outside, there's always a chance for infection. And that's what happens sometimes with these. There is a power cord about the size and diameter of your little finger. It's white. It comes out of the abdomen. And it's attached to a power-based unit that's about the size of an old-fashioned cell phone. And you wear that on a shoulder holster, and you have a backup battery as sort of a shoulder holster on the other side. And with that arrangement, you can go out and do whatever you want. The thing I've learned from doing these over the last decade or so is that the patients are so much more appreciative of the extra time they have with a VAD, but even more appreciative of the quality of life they have, because no longer are they sleeping bolt upright because they're afraid they're going to drown if they lay flat. They aren't coming back and forth to the hospital feeling short of breath and having to get medications to get water weight off of them all the time. They are able to go out and have vacations and make love to their wives or husbands and rake leaves and all sorts of things that they couldn't do when they were limited by their congestive heart failure.
But they do have to remain on anticoagulant, clot-preventing medication forevermore.
Exactly. That's a very good point. They do have to be on blood thinners because, again, getting back to the point, when blood is in contact with an artificial substance, it does tend to form clots. So they do have to be on Coumadin or warfarin, but they don't have to be on immunosuppression. So for those people, interestingly enough, who might be a high PRA, this might be the better option in the long run.
And the high PRA would be people who have antibodies against human antigens that would react to a transplanted heart.
Right. Forgive me for, we were talking offline earlier about the fact that when we evaluate for somebody for a transplant, we do as part of that evaluation what's called a panel reactive antibody, and that is an ability to predict how many types of antigens you've been exposed to in the past, which therefore makes it more likely for you to reject any transplanted heart. And those patients who, and the field of immunology is evolving as well, so that I would anticipate within a few years, we'll have much more sensitive and specific ways to identify those patients that are likely to have rejection problems. Well, they might be better served with the mechanical option. Patients who have no issues with immunology may be better served with the biological option, and they would be the candidates to dip into the pool, the very limited pool of donor organs.
260-452-1185 is the number to call if you'd like to ask a question or comment. We're talking about all matters of the heart this episode of Midday Matters, and to do that, we have Dr. Joseph Ladowski from Lutheran Hospital. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, at nipr.fm. That's our email address, or our Facebook page, Midday Matters. I'm kind of wondering, is there a typical candidate that is more likely to get a transplant versus the assisted device? Is there, kind of a poster child for either way to go?
Mm-hmm. The selection process for a heart transplant is very rigorous, and it is usually inclined towards people who are younger. Because if you think about it, the mechanical device option is a good option right now, but we don't really know the durability of it. Mm. Whereas I could give you numbers just a little while ago about our 15-year survival with heart transplants. So if you're a fairly young person, if you're a non-smoker, it's obligatory that you be a non-smoker. And the reason for that is because if you are on immunosuppression and you smoke, you're about 9 times more likely to develop a lung cancer. Mm. Your own body at any given time is policing itself and wiping out little aberrant cells that might arise, and thereby nipping in the bud a lot of cancers that can occur. If you are on immunosuppression, you can't do that. And so smoking is an absolute forbidden thing if you're a heart transplant candidate. You have to have a strong support system as well. I always tell people as well that as in addition to it being trading one set of problems for another, we kind of become your family after a heart transplant because you have to have very frequent and compulsive follow-up. We want to make sure that we address any problems before they become severe problems. For example, the patient who will have a heart transplant will have a procedure called an endomyocardial biopsy several times in the first few months. So they should live close to wherever the heart transplant was done for convenience reasons and for safety reasons as well. And so we do these endomyocardial biopsies, and they are an outpatient procedure, about like starting a large IV in the neck. And it allows us then to sample the transplanted heart. We get almost microscopic portions of it so that we can look at it under a microscope and tell you if you're starting to have rejection before you have rejection. That's one thing. We also do clinic visits to make sure that your blood pressure, cholesterol level, all of these other things are working out well.
We have a caller on line one. Daniel, we have just about a minute left in today's program if you want to ask your question really quickly.
Yeah, on the horizon might be custom-grown replacement organs, and what are the prospects like 20, 40, whatever number of years in the future for custom-grown hearts from adult stem cells, I think is how I heard about it, the idea anyway?
That's a pretty complex issue. I don't think it's on the near horizon. 2040, yeah, maybe. I don't know that we're going to be able to completely grow an entire organ when we can't really even replace myocytes, just the muscle cells themselves, quite yet. I think the mechanical option will be a good option for many years to come. They have a lot of interest in the possibility of sort of cloning technology that would develop organs, but that's a long way down the road. Another thing that is being worked on very actively is something called xenotransplants. That means taking an organ from a different species. And there's a possibility, not a strong possibility in the near future, but a possibility that they will be able to raise genetically modified pigs with a similar sized heart that have very few antigens that a human would react to. This has been going on for a lot of years, though, and I have to tell you that when heart transplant surgeons get together and somebody gets up and says, you know, I'm on the verge of getting a pig that we will have very few antigens in, and it, within a couple years we're going to be transplanting their hearts into humans, somebody else will say, yeah, when pigs fly.
We're actually going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much, Dr. Joseph Ladowski, for being a part of Health 360 today. You're listening to Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 HD Channel 1 and streaming online at nipr.fm. This is WBOY Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. And support for Midday Matters on WBOY is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence, serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com. We're coming up on 1 o'clock, and Fresh Air is up next.